With Shift Work, a podcast made in collaboration with RWCF and HRN, we're shifting the conversation about how the restaurant food you love makes its way to the table. Listen to and follow Shift Work on your favorite podcast app.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. This is Monday, February 7th, 2022, and I'm doing a special on-the-road episode. I'm out here in Framingham, Massachusetts, somewhere between Worcester and Boston, and we're kind of getting ready for the Craft Malt Conference, so I'm tracking down a brewer who uses a lot of local malt, and I've been wanting to meet for many years, and let him introduce himself.
Hi, my name is Matthew Steinberg. I'm the co-founder and head brewer at Exhibit A Brewing Company here in Framingham. Been here about 5.5 years. Excited to talk about local grains.
That's great, man. So the Craft Malt Conference is coming up. We're doing a number of shows in and around local malt and craft malt over this month of February 2022. But going way back with you, man, 2016, we're on the road up in Finger Lakes, New York. I was with a friend who's also your friend, Tor Eschner. And he pulled out a beer that he said he was drinking all that year, and it was Exhibit A Brewing, some kind of beer with Danko rye. So tell me about that beer and the whole connection between the maltster and how you end up getting grain from, you know, New York and other places. I want to hear your whole story because you're quite an amazing person and that you really have been focused on local sourcing. And to me, that's really the future of what's going on now in craft beer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I met Tor through Andrea and Chris at Valley Malt. I want to say it was probably 2013 or 2014. They had an event called Barley Fest, and it took place in Amherst. And we had beer dinners and seminars, and you know, the folks at Hardwick College presented to us about you know, grain, the science of all of this and the farming and all. And so I meet Tor, I find out he's this amazing farmer and incredible guy. And he has this rye and he has this amazing warthog wheat. So flash forward to when we opened, we decided we got to make this, we got to use some of this Danko. And we decided to highlight it in this kind of 6% Simcoe driven IPA with roughly 30% rye malt. And yeah, it's a fun one for us. We brew it 4 or 5 times a year. And actually, we just brewed a batch last week. So it's pretty exciting.
I got to make sure I try that. So we're out here at the brewery. And tell us like how you got started and why. I know you mentioned a little bit, but why did you get so into, you know, using local malt? And you're part of this Northeast Grains Shed Alliance.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't occur to me to not care about the ingredients. You know, when I started homebrewing, I was in Flagstaff, Arizona, and I'm buying like German malt and English malt and German hops and, hops from the Pacific Northwest. But there was nothing from where I was, aside from the water and the effort, the labor, there was nothing local. So I immediately started thinking about like, what can I do to have a local material in my beer? So I grew hops in the yard, and we used a little bit, you know, but then as I grew from a home brewer to a professional brewer, I started to realize that there really wasn't a lot available. You know, back 23 years ago, you could not find local grains or local hops in the Northeast. And so, you know, my career just went the way it was. I couldn't find these things. I, you know, used the best quality things we could find. And then, you know, when I was working in Amherst at a little brew pub there, High Horse, I came across Andrea and Chris at Valley Malt, and they were like, "Oh, we're malting barley and wheat here in the valley. We'd love to talk to you about getting some of the grains into those beers." So we bought in right away. We started using their grains immediately, and presented the beers as truly local. You know,
so what was the challenge of using local malt rather than, you know, more of a mainstream malt where you know everything about it?
I think the biggest challenge was just the unknown. We didn't know what it would deliver. We didn't know how efficient they would be. We didn't necessarily know what flavors they would deliver. And what we discovered was they were actually delivering flavor that was kind of unique to our region. So I started to think about, you know, all these German style beers or English style beers or, you know, other beers that take from a place. Kolsch is a great example. You know, our Goody Two Shoes is like that. So if you for a moment think like, as an American brewer, I'm adjusting my water, I'm adjusting my mash regimen to match something to kind of try to get an authentic tribute to, say, a style from Germany. Well, why do I need to do that? I can just brew a beer with our flavors, with our terroir, and create a unique beer that's, you know, truly regional.
Wow, that's right on. I think when I first met Andrew Stanley at Valley Malt, they initially, about 2014, did want to send some malt down to New York and New York brewers, and we did an event with her. But it seemed that very quickly she was selling all her malt to just this part of Massachusetts.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of breweries jumped on board with them early on. You know, our buddies at Wormtown Brewing, and certainly there's other breweries in the area. I can't name them who use them now, but there's plenty. You know, that was a kind of an interesting time because we all of a sudden, everybody kind of wanted it that knew about it, right? If you knew how great it was, how the quality was there, freshness, you know, original style malts too. Like they weren't just kind of emulating what already exists. They were actually creating new things that we could use and create beers around those malts.
Wow, and you're a great indie craft brewery. I mean, I've been staying north of Boston, and there's a great store there called RMA Craft Beer in Amesbury. And he only gets your beers if I ask for it. Occasionally he'll get a couple of them. How did you figure out your distribution? You know, you're an indie brewery, and it seems right now that it's hard. But you guys are just making amazing beer. And I'm always drawn to the indie breweries and more than ever the breweries using craft malt.
Yeah. I mean, we started as a self-distributing brewery. We had one truck, one salesperson who also collected checks and took orders and all of that. I think the hardest part was, you know, finding the right stores to sell our beers in, being picky about that. We didn't have a lot of beer to go around, so we had to kind of pick and choose who was able to get our beer. You know, back in those days, one might even say that we were kind of selfish with our beers. And I kind of wear that with a badge of honor, you know. 2 years in, we decided, okay, it's time to release our beers to a wholesaler. We partnered with Atlantic Beverage Distributors out of Holliston, Massachusetts, and they brought us from 200 retailers that we were self-managing up to now we're in over 1,500 retailers in Massachusetts.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it feels pretty good. You know, Cat's Meow is as if it's our flagship, if you want to call it that. That's about 50% of our volume, and it's in all 1,500 of those accounts. Our other beers are in some of those accounts or most of those accounts, and we have five beers in our core portfolio plus seasonals and one-offs and things like that. We have also expanded outside of Massachusetts to New York, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Maine. You know, I will say that some of those expansions are pretty minimal. Like, we don't ship a lot of beer to New York, but my brother lives in New York, so I got to be in New York with the beer.
That sounds good to me.
Same with Maine. My daughter's in college in Maine, so why not, you know, tie our trips up there and go to Navari and drink our beers there at other places as well. We also sell our beer in Arizona and California. We also do direct shipment to various markets that legally allow us to. So we're in Virginia and Nebraska, Washington, D.C., New Hampshire, Mass. There's a few others that we can ship beer directly to, Pennsylvania. Actually, I don't know about Pennsylvania. I might be making that up. And then Japan. We sell beer in Japan.
Well, we're going to have to make a map of all the states you're in so we can take a tour. Yeah. Let's open this up and tell me the backstory again of this beer, and is this a Massachusetts terroir beer?
Well, I would say that this has some malt that's processed here in Massachusetts, but it also has some German malt.
Cheers.
Cheers to you. Goody Two Shoes. This is our Kolsch. Mm. And this was canned last week, so it's fresh and beautiful. So to me, like, this is kind of the soul of our brewery. I care a lot about the Kolsch style. Anybody who's talked to me about brewing or beer styles, or what's your favorite, what's your desert island beer. Kolsch is that beer generally for me. There's a lot of really good examples coming out these days. I'd like to say that we're kind of trying to lead that pack a little bit, certainly here in Massachusetts. Goody Two Shoes has some of Tora's wheat. It also has a grain in it called Va Va Vom, which is basically a dextrin malt that Andrea and Chris developed for us and other brewers, but I kind of tasked them with it, and I was like, hey, I need this grain. I want to buy it from you. Let's do it. And so it's a really beautiful dextrin malt. It gives the beer a little more body and some nice texture.
You know, now you're getting me to where I wanted to go in the world of craft malt. Andrea had mentioned, talk about the dextrin malt story. So just tell us how you worked with the maltsters on that and why that's so important to this beer.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to find a way to still have a very dry beer that has some mouthfeel. Cheers.
Cheers.
And it's a challenge. Like, we want a low mash temperature so the beer dries out and attenuates fully. So there's not a lot of residual sugar, but we wanted the beer to have some body to it and some texture to it that would be delivered only through kind of unfermentable sugars, right? So to balance that is not necessarily easy. There's a lot of malts that you can buy that will kind of try to perform that, or, you know, they're designed to perform that way. We went through several batches with Valley Malt to find this sort of sweet spot, and they seem to really have nailed it. And we're buying a lot of this grain. You know, it's in almost every beer we brew, and you know, it's a relatively small percentage. You're talking about 8 or 10% of the grist, which is actually a similar amount that we use wheat and some other grains in the beer, Vienna as well. And so Vienna from Valley Malt, not from Germany,
of course.
So it's really nice to be able to start from that ground up and create something basically that doesn't exist yet.
What was that process of like exploring this ingredient? Did you have a set recipe and you were looking for certain, you know, measurable qualities?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Diastatic power and just the ability for the grain to do its thing based on our needs. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but if I did, I could tell you all of the things that we wanted out of this barley. You know, like I said, there's other companies that make grains like this, other dextrin malts. There's, you know, Weyermann makes their version, and Rahr makes their version, and Simpsons makes their version. But there really wasn't anything coming from local malt houses that would deliver what we were looking for. And Chris and Andrea just kind of knew from the conversations that we had what I wanted and what I was trying to get it to deliver in our beers. And I believe that even our hop-forward beers, whether they're our IPAs like Danko or the Cat's Meow, and we have Just a Kitten here that we'll taste, you know, malt is so vital to these beers. And sometimes they kind of like, attention on hops kind of pulls away from, I think, the, you know, the validity of and the importance of malt and grain in the beer. So
let's talk about you. So it sounds like you're a science guy, and maybe the future of craft beer is science plus this agriculture.
Yeah.
Tell us a little more about you and what skills you brought that is making these beers so good.
I'd like to just say that I'm lucky. I definitely am not a scientist. I went to school for business. My stepfather growing up, though, he was the earth science teacher at my high school, department head of science, so he put it in me big time. You know, he constantly was like, science, no matter what you do, is important. Mathematics, no matter what you do. I was a musician in those days, still kind of twiddle around a little bit on the guitar, and I used to play saxophone. Math is so important, you know, in those things. And I can't even tell you how much, I mean, I was using crazy math this morning just trying to figure out some inventory things, you know, and for me, the art and the science meet somewhere.
You mean like 1001, 1002?
I had to count in order. It's nutty. End of month stuff. It's, you know, people think that brewing beer is just like, you know, mashing in and hoping for the best. It's actually a lot of math and counting and business operations that I never anticipated. I do kind of lean on the art side of things as far as like when I design or conceptualize a beer. And I understand what the science does, and I understand how to make our systems work with that. I don't pretend for a minute that I'm a scientist, and we don't have, we have a laboratory here, and we have someone that's managing that, and he's amazing, Andrew Gill. And so Andrew, you know, he observes our yeast. He's the one that's kind of in charge of the management of our yeast, which I think is really where the science is, you know, I feel like the conceptualization of these recipes, as much as it is reliant on the science, it is very much about the art. And for us, like, developing the flavors we're looking for.
Well, I'm here drinking beers with Matthew at Exhibit A Brewing. We're drinking the Goody Two Shoes Kolsch style ale. That's really why I came here, man, because there's nothing like drinking beer with the brewer. So in terms of science and everything, I just want to go into, like, different types of grain. So I know from my world, the early local malt talk was about also getting growers to, you know, work with rye and emmer and other traditional hardy Northeastern grains. So I know you're a part of the Northeast Grain Shed Alliance. Let's talk about the farming side and the grain side and that organization, because I know that that's one of the things where you really stand out, and I'm really proud of you and proud to meet you.
Yeah, I'm super proud of the Northeast Grain Shed Alliance and what we're putting together. You know, our brewery, Exhibit A Brewing, is a founding member among many other breweries that are founding members. I happen to also be on the advisory board, and I'm also on the Square Foot Project. So the Square Foot Project basically is a way for us to give a measurement of how much farmland we're supporting with these beers. So the math is fun, but really what it comes down to is for every pint of beer that uses local grains, we're supporting anywhere between, say, 2 and 6 square feet of farmland. The important part of that, obviously, we could talk about, like, you know, the work that goes into it. These farmers have all this land, and they have ways to, you know, manage that land. And if they can grow grain as a cover crop and then some other, you know, whatever else they're growing on their land, we can support them by kind of guaranteeing that these grains will be processed and purchased. That part's very exciting, because I think one of the parts that farmers struggle with a lot is just, we're going to grow it, but who's going to buy it? You know, and so there's this kind of give and take with that. We're actually in the process now. We're about to brew the first of many, hopefully, Square Foot Project collaboration beers. We're brewing it at Big Alice Brewing in Long Island City. John down there is going to be...
John and Kyle, my brothers.
Yeah, I haven't met them face-to-face, I don't think, but we've been on the phone a ton, and we're going to go down there for the beer, for the brew. And
I think that they're speaking at the Craft Malt Conference,
yeah,
too.
John, I think they both are.
I'm not sure. I just saw Big Al, so it might be John.
Yeah, I think John is speaking for sure. He's on a panel, I think, and doing his thing. The other breweries that are involved with that, we've got... Kent Falls, Barry from Connecticut is coming, and I'm going to forget all the other breweries, but Amory's Tomb here in Massachusetts, and us, and I don't remember. I'm trying to think of all the other breweries.
No, it's on the list. And when I actually just look at the Northeast Grains Grain Shed Alliance, I spend more time up in the Boston area, and I want to go to all those businesses. I want to go to the bakeries. I want to go to the breweries. I want to meet the farmers. So it's really putting the spotlight on New England, just how these small farms and small businesses are working together. And I think it's a model for the whole nation.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, this is the lead up to Square Foot Saturday, which is the inaugural first time we're going to do it. It's April 2nd, 2022. And the idea is to just really promote the use of local grains on that day and every day, but certainly on that day. It's, you know, April 2nd will kind of hopefully be one of those ways of getting people to come out and in support of Square Foot.
Wait, this is cool, man. Yeah. Square Foot Saturday is April 2nd.
It is. Square Foot Saturday is April 2nd. And I didn't even tell you what kind of beer we're making, but we're using Hudson Valley malts and Valley malts, and we're creating a kind of 5.5% to 6% amber lager, like a Vienna lager. Simple beer, malt focused. And that was kind of the idea. We were like, we should just make sure that we're brewing a beer that really kind of highlights what it is these farmers do every day and what the processors are doing.
Let's talk about beer style for a minute. So you mentioned Vienna Lager. It's one of my favorite spring summer beers. I've had some good ones. One a couple years ago, Innerbauer made one called Dead Presidents that I was really jamming with. Why Vienna Lager? Is it because of the malt, or did you want to make that style and you sought out the malt?
No, that was an interesting conversation, or several conversations, to get to that style. Originally, I thought like, oh, we should make like an alt beer. Well, alt beer is kind of like hybrid amber lager. It's not all that far off, right? I mean, it's malt forward. And then we talked about doing like...
I like alt beers.
I love alt beer. And so we could do an ESB, we could do something like this, but we were like, we should do a lager because, you know, not all of us get to brew lagers. We had some time. They had the tank space and tank time that they could offer at Big Alice, so that made sense. And, you know, Exhibit A is kind of a hop-forward brewery generally. If you ask the general person who's aware of us, they'd be like, oh, yeah, the Cat's Meow. You know, they brew a lot of IPAs. I mean, we're a portfolio brewery, though. We have more non-IPAs than we do IPAs, right? And so I think, you know, we leaned into the style after talking about the grains that we knew would be one available, ones we wanted to use, and ones that would kind of reflect the spirit behind Square Foot, which is... you know, barley, wheat, rye, emmer, buckwheat, whatever we're using. I mean, we're sticking with, I think, just barley in this case. But you know, we had an opportunity to really highlight the grain that we're proud to use every day.
How specific do you get, like your transparency? You know, the maltster, do you know the actual farm that's raising the grain for this project?
Yeah, that's going to be, it'll, that information will be on the label, I believe, or at least in the, you know, in the social media stuff for sure. The thing that I've really enjoyed about some of the local malt houses that I've worked with, mostly Valley Malt in this case, but if I want to know where the grain came from, I can find out, you know, and actually sometimes it's on my packing slip. It's not necessarily on the bags, but the lot number is, and I can look up the lot number by my purchase order, my delivery slip, and I can be like, oh yeah, that's definitely came from Ochsner Farm, or this came from another farm. And that part to me is like, that's the thing. That's like, in the tap room, when people are like, oh yeah, we really like local beer. It's like, oh cool. So do we. And this is why we consider our beer so local, because we, you know, we've got the local water, we've got the local labor. But, you know, the hops in this grow in Germany, you know, because there are no Tetnangs grown in the U.S. that I feel comfortable putting into this beer. So I do compromise in that sense, I guess, if you will. I think it's important to, for us, at least for me as a brewer, I want to still have an authentic tribute. If I'm trying to highlight a style like Kolsch in this case, it needs to be spot on. I can't just mess around with it. It needs to kind of reflect the spirit, the true authenticity of that style and that place and the culture.
And you nailed it with I actually had a sample of this Goody Two Shoes Kolsch style last month, I believe. And you really nailed it. There's the dryness. So you're saying that's because of the certain malt you used?
Well, it's the fermentation profile and the mash regimen for sure. But yeah, the malt bill that we use delivers, the yeast will ferment pretty dry. We tend to keep it right around 2 Plato with a finish, which is, I mean, we could dig into the numbers if we want, but it's relatively dry, but it definitely has some sweetness because the malt is present. And sometimes people would refer to those flavors as kind of like, not wine-like, but having that sort of vinous quality. I pick up cereal. I get grain and cereal in the finish of the beer. That's just where my palate lies. I mean, it's such a treat to be able to brew a beer with ingredients that are so great, but also that ends up being this wonderful product.
You know, this beer, Goody Two Shoes, when people say, like, there was a joke, I think it was... Yeppe from Evil Twin said that there's people that they're trying to make beer that's for people that don't like beer and with different flavors and things. And when I drink this beer, I'm like, this tastes like beer. How would you describe to someone that's new? Like, my daughter's going to be 21 soon. You know, they're drinking non-beer products. Yeah. And how do you explain to someone what should beer taste like and what is this Kolsch if that's what beer should taste like?
Yeah, so I start with non-sugar cereal. So whether it's grape nuts, you know, Special K, some kind of like grain-driven cereal, Cheerios. Heat it up. Tell me what that smells like. Tell me what that tastes like. Don't put milk in it. Just, you know. And I do start with that cereal kind of mindset, if you will. And I think it's important for us to realize that, like, beer-flavored beer is what we've – why do we need to escape that, you know? And I think there are consumers out there that are not looking for beer-flavored beer. They're looking for these pastry beers or beers that just kind of push – other flavor components. I love beer, so why not make a beer that actually tastes like it, you know? But I mean, grape nuts is my favorite cereal, so I tend to lean on that one a little bit, and I do say, like, it tastes like grape nuts when we're mashing in. Like, it smells like it. And I'll take, like, a little bit of mash, and I'll put it in a big bowl of grape nuts, and I'll mix it up, and I'll be like, there's my cereal.
That's a good dividing line. Start with grape nuts, and you can leave the I don't even know the other cereals' names. Fruity something and Captain something on the sidelines.
Yeah, get rid of all those sugar cereals. Wow.
Hey, man, we're off to a great start here. I can't believe it. I'm at Exhibit A Brewing. I've wanted to come here for 6 years. I took a train from Boston. I got off in Framingham, and I walked the scary streets of Framingham, took some photos too, which I'll be posting, and I'm here. We'll take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Hi, I'm Kiki Luya, the Executive Director of Restaurant Workers Community Foundation, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Shift Work. In the last 6 months, some 6,500 restaurants have closed their doors, and there's never been a time when restaurants and their 12 million workers have been more vulnerable. It's time to transform hospitality. With Shift Work, a podcast made in collaboration with RWCF and HRN, we're shifting the conversation about how the restaurant food you love makes its way to the table. What does it really take to make that experience happen? And who are the countless workers responsible? We're talking porters, cleaning crew, prep cooks, servers, baristas, hosts, bartenders, barbacks, managers, sommeliers, and chefs. I'll also introduce you to organizations that are leading industry transformation. We'll discuss mental health, fair pay, racial justice, and how hospitality can change for the better. We need it. Listen to and follow Shift Work on your favorite podcast app.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host of Beer Sessions Radio. And don't forget to join us, support, and become a member at heritageradionetwork.org. So I'm out here in Framingham, Massachusetts, not too far outside of Boston, with a malt and like local source-driven brewer, Matthew, of Exhibit A Brewing. All right, Matthew, we're having a great conversation. So you're saying you like beer-flavored beer.
I do. I like other things too, you know, like water and cereal.
Well, there's some fun. So I got to try some of your beers recently, and there was one called Briefcase Porter, and what I liked was actually on the can, it had a nice description of the malts, and this one said, "This porter satisfies without being heavy, toasted dark bread and nutty aromas, followed by lightly roasted coffee, dark chocolate, blackberry finish, da-da-da." I mean, that's pretty great. Like, to read on a beer label, the malt inspiration is pretty cool.
Yeah, so when we first opened, I'm a big fan of porter as a whole. And so I'm actually going to open up another beer here. Jimmy.
Tell me what it is, too.
This is Just a Kitten, which is our Vic Secret and Mosaic-driven New England IPA. It's about 5% IPA, 5% alcohol. It's loaded with Ochsner Farms Warthog wheat and a bunch of Va Va Vome in there as well, some oats.
And if you're just tuning in, we're kind of getting ready for the Craft Malt Conference, which is a little later in February. It's virtual this year, but Matthew is one of the dedicated craft malt users in New England. So Porter, man. Porter as a style, I love it. I love hearing about brown ale and porters. Not, a couple weeks ago, we talked with Julia Herz, who's now the new head of the Homebrewers, National Homebrewers Association, American Homebrewers Association. And we just talked about beer styles and how exciting that is. And we were talking about beer-flavored beers. And I really do feel that homebrewing is going to tie people in to really knowing more about beer styles. And traditional beer styles, and so how does porter fit into that? Because I feel like you got to know porter. Is porter a hard beer to make?
You know, it's funny, as a home brewer, and this is like early mid '90s. It was the first style of beer I made, and I had a dog named Kona. So I made a Kona coffee porter, of course, and my email was even like Kona Brewer. And my beer advocate name's Kona Brewer, and I had all the, you know, it all stuck. The dog's been gone for more than a decade.
You never got sued for that now.
No, but I did get an email at some point or a letter asking if I would be willing to give it up. And I was like, no, I don't see a reason. I don't, you know. It was from a brewery that used that word, so that was forever ago. But, yeah, I mean, porter to me was an important style to kind of, I wanted to master it. I wanted to be great at brewing it. When I was in college, I was buying, you know, 50-liter kegs of Sierra Porter and Anchor Porter, and we just fell in love with that style. And talk about a malt-focused product, you know. And so I worked at another brewery here in Massachusetts called Mayflower Brewing, and Mayflower Porter kind of has since become, I would say, one of the locally known, very popular porters. It's probably one of the most popular here in Massachusetts. I'd like to believe that our Briefcase Porter is on its heels for sure. So Briefcase Porter kind of came out of this idea that every brewery should have a porter. You know, briefcase, albeit as unnecessary as a briefcase actually is, find me anyone working that has a computer that doesn't have some kind of briefcase type of device, whether it's a, you know, a shoulder bag, but it's a briefcase. So it's necessary. As is a porter in your portfolio as a brewery, as far as I'm concerned. And what I did when I got first started is I called Andrea and I was like, hey, I need some roasted grains. She's like, yeah, we don't do that, sort of. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? She's like, well, we can kind of make you some roasted grains. I'm like, cool, let's do it. So they had a tiny little roasting device and they were making me like 15 pounds at a time or 10 pounds at a time, which was not sustainable. And I said, look, I'm going to buy all of my roasted grains from you. Let's put together a plan. They invested in a roaster that they now have and has been operating for several years now. And so we get brown malt from them, like in the old English tradition of brown malt. We get chocolate wheat, chocolate rye, chocolate barley, roasted barley. We use roasted oats and everything kind of in between. And in our porter, we have a combination of chocolate wheat, a bit of roasted barley, and a bunch of brown malt. And what I think that delivers for us is it gives us big, smooth, bready, toasty quality without kind of being overly bitter, overly roasted. So it doesn't have that big astringent character that some of the grains can deliver. And so we're pretty, you know, judicious with it, if you will. And we look at that porter as kind of like drinking beer. You know, it's not meant to just kind of, it's meant to blow your socks off flavor wise, but it's meant to be super drinkable and approachable. And, you know, and for me, it's like lawnmower beer just happens to be dark, you know.
Well, that's how it should be. You know, yeah. The famous Irish dry stout is only like 3.5%, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it happens to be 5.5% or 5.4%, but it's super drinkable. And generally speaking, when I like to lead, if people are like, I don't really like beer, I'm like, well, I could start you with the lighter one, with the Kolsch, and that tastes like beer. So that might not be what you're looking for. So I tend to actually go right to the dark beers. Like if it's a person that generally isn't into beer, but they drink like coffee and they like chocolate, and I try to approach it from that that palate sense. It's like, do you like coffee? And I mean, find me someone who doesn't drink coffee. I don't happen to drink coffee, but I love coffee. I just can't handle caffeine. You can tell from my energy level, I don't need it. But with beers that are like kind of putting out those flavors, whether it's coffee, chocolate, toasted bread, a palate that isn't into beer may very much love that style because, one, they may not even be aware of it, and they likely aren't, especially if they've kind of been at beer averse.
So it's kind of like saying, do you like red wine? You might want to try this.
Yeah, yeah.
So if we can ask about one of your favorites that you don't brew, a dark beer that you could say I enjoy drinking.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, there's so many.
Just pick one.
I mean, you mentioned Chris Loring before, and I haven't seen Chris in forever, but that Chino Pivo beer that he makes, that dark kind of Polish lager, I think it's a Polish lager. I don't know, but it's
Czech. Maybe it's Polish, Czech, but it's Czech.
It's a dark lager. It's incredible. I really like that one. You know, if I go back to like in my head of what beers I really liked then, I mean, Sierra Porter was that beer. Like it brought me into dark beers. Same with Anchor Porter. You know, locally, I would say, you know, there's a couple of really good other porters. Obviously, we mentioned Mayflower before. But yeah, it's sometimes hard. I don't get out enough to drink other people's.
No, I was just going to ask you that, but I'm there with you too. Notch Brewing with their Czech Darks. And I just had Schilling's, it's called Modernism. That's also a Czech style dark lager. So we're on kind of the same page. I'm holding the mic here. I want to hear about Cat's Meow because, just locally in Boston area, people have said that, yeah, that's the go-to. How did that become your like top beer, and was that the intention when you made it?
I mean, with any portfolio, you just never know what's going to take off, you know? We started with this naming regimen called Demo Tape, and every beer was Demo Tape. Demo Tape 1, 2, 3, up to 27 is where we stopped, I think. And Demo Tape 1 was this kind of golden colored beer that was just a test of the brew system and test of the canning system. Demo Tape 2 was an IPA, and Demo Tape 4 was closer to the Cat's Meow IPA. And then we just went with it. I think we didn't, you know, when I got started, I was like, I don't want animals on my label. I don't want like animal references. And now I got like, I got rabbits and cats.
Oh, yeah. Hair Razor. I special order that just so you know. Today. Hair Razor double IPA.
Yeah, I'll send you some home because we're canning it right now. I think that it was pretty. It happened pretty quick that we realized that this cute little cat on the label was going to do well for us. We developed the beer over time. Like it is not the same beer that it was when we first brewed it. And I'm proud of that. And in fact, I think most breweries would have to admit to themselves, yeah, our beers change, you know, agriculture changes, the ingredients change, the seasons change things, like the barometric pressure makes our boil different. You know, it's like everything is, you know, handmade here. So I think the exciting thing for us is really nailing down what we're intending the beer to be and then try to get as close to that every time. And with the Cat's Meow, the last, say, 3 years, it's really been honed in and tasting on point basically every time we brew it. If it's not perfect, we don't sell it. We dump it, you know, and thankfully, I don't know that we've ever had a batch of cat that we didn't, that wasn't as intended, but we've had other beers that have fallen short and we dump them. But with that beer, Citra, Mosaic, El Dorado, those hops are the leaders in that beer. Again, with Warthog Wheat from Ochsner Farm, the Va Va Vome, and some flaked oats in this one. And we have an English barley that we use called Golden Promise from Simpsons. Which we actually really adore that grain. And, you know, if we could just get one from them that's local here, maybe have those guys grow those grains here. But until that happens, we'll just suffer through the amazing Simpsons.
You know, when I walked in, Matt, you said, oh, I was talking to someone who knows you. And in my mind, I've been thinking about Tor Eschner up in the Finger Lakes and him tasting me on your Danko Rye beer 2016. Tell me again what that beer is, and is there anything you want to say about this specialty grain farmer? Because if you ever been to his farm, you know that this guy is a master mechanic with every type of machinery. He's tweaked to work to make the grain and the harvesting of the grain, everything better. Then you go into his house, and the steps leading up to his house creak and are loose because he puts everything, he leaves it out there in the grain farm.
Yeah, well, first I want to say this, and I'm embarrassed to say I have not been to Sitor.
Because you're too busy working here.
Busy. He understands. I do ship him some beer on occasion, so he gets a little gift pack, a little care package every once in a while. I am going to visit him both this spring and also at harvest this year. He does not know that, so he will find out after hearing this, but I do plan to come and visit this year, and I want to bring some of our staff up there and really see what's going on in the Finger Lakes at his farm. But hanging out with Tor many, many times here in Massachusetts, at Andrea's house and during Barley Fest, and we've done some other things together. He and Rachel are amazing. I can't stress enough that there's something really amazing about doing business with people that you like and that you have a ton of, appreciation for what they do, but also like reliability. You know, I rely on them to grow this incredible malt, to grow this incredible grain that can then be processed by these monsters. I can't imagine not having that reliable source, you know? And so that's why we do this, because the more we buy, the more reliable they become, because they can rely on us to be their customers, you know? So Danko Rye, homebrewing. Again, mid-90s. I moved to Colorado in 1998 after I graduated college and then went to Colorado for a couple of years. And there was a homebrew shop that was closing. And he had all this grain, like, on clearance. And so I bought a whole bag, a 55-pound bag of, like, British rye malt. I'd never used it before, but I grew up, you know, Jewish kid in New England. I was like, rye is the thing.
Rye bread.
Yeah, rye bread. My parents always had, like, you know, rye pumpernickel bread in the house. And I always loved rye. I loved caraway seeds. So I developed this idea for a beer called, it was basically called Rye Knot, which was a rye beer with sort of dry hopped, if you will, with caraway seed. And it was like spicy and peppery and really interesting. And I did brew a few batches of those beers as a home brewer. And then I also, at a brew pub I worked at on Martha's Vineyard called Offshore Ale, I brewed a beer called Rye Hop, which was kind of in spirit of that. I still plan to do some projects here with that idea. But I from brewing those beers with rye back then, I knew how original the beers tasted and how there were no beers like this around. Finding rye beer was really difficult. I mean, there was some cool European things coming in, but not a lot of places were brewing rye beers. Sometimes you find a brew pub here and there, but there was nothing in the store.
Like in Germany, they have the Rogan beers.
Rogan beers, yeah. And so there was some of that, and a lot of those are smoky and wacky and interesting. But for my palate back then, I was like, I don't even know what half of this is. You know, mind you, I was 22 or whatever, 25. But I think I just grasped onto it. I just found rye to be super tasty, and it kind of came from maybe a little bit of like caring about my heritage and the rye bread thing. And maybe, you know, there was one, rye is their juniper berries in my beer. And that was like a rye beer with whirlpooled with juniper berries and rose hips, I think. And then we dry hopped it with like crystal hops or something. And it was real gentle and great, real great beer. But I think there's so much out there that we don't even touch on. And as a production brewery, I kind of need to do the things that we're good at and, you know, pay the bills and give us some creative freedom. But like the staff back there is like, we want to try this. And I'm like, let's go for it. Let's do it. And so we don't have a pilot system here, but we have a way of making small batch beers out of, say, wort that we're making for other beers. And we can ferment those separately, or we can age them, condition them separately, dry hop them different, whatever. And so we're working on projects like that. We have, and basically that's all taproom only stuff that, you know, we'll do like a, I don't know, we're working on a new fruit beer called Panda Punch, and that's a kettle sour. And so they're like, well, what can we do with, like, can we like take some of it and not fruit it and not put the hibiscus in and then do something else with it? I'm like, yeah, take a few barrels out and play with it, see what happens. So
it's fun. So you mentioned the tap room. So we're in Framingham. So if you don't drive or you're in Boston, you can just jump on a train and come out here. It's not that far. I like it. I like these old industrial towns. But we're in a brewery. Like, this is a real working brewery. Is the tap room here also?
Yeah. So we're actually here in one of the sort of side rooms. We're in the process now of designing a whole new expansion for the tap room that's going to go into the office area with a kitchen and the whole thing. So we're going to definitely expand our tap room plans. You can see, not the people listening, but Jimmy can see that we have a couple pinball machines here. They're fun. And then we have, we do comedy nights, live music, always original live music. We don't hire cover bands. It's nothing really wrong with a cover band, but like we're in a, you know, because of the pandemic, a lot of these indie bands that are original, doing original music, have no place to play. And they haven't had a place to play for 2 years. So when we opened, Kelsey Roth and I, Kelsey's our GM, he is big into indie music and original bands. And so we immediately said, okay, we're not hiring cover bands. We're going to hire bands that play original music. They could toss in a Fleetwood Mac or a Van Halen cover if they want. But the reality is we want original music in this place. And we've really done a great job of having that happen. So in the brewery on Fridays, production shuts down at 4 o'clock. We're done for the day. It's kind of a cleanup day anyway. We don't do a lot of production on Fridays. And we rope off the tanks, the canning line, everything's kind of protected, or the guest is protected, I should say. And then and we put up a big 12-foot movie screen and my parents' rug from the 80s for the drummers, and we just do it, and we have live.
Because drummers need rugs.
Apparently the drummer needs a rug. And anytime I see the drummer or the band comes in, I'm like, I got to tell you about this rug. And it was literally, it's some kind of Persian rug my stepmom bought in the probably early 80s. And I had it in the dorm rooms in college. And that poor rug has been through the ringer. But
I will say, I love that. I think about Brooklyn Brewery in the late 90s before it got to expand. But their production area was the same thing. They'd rope it off, and that would be the tap room. And there's good vibes there, man. You really got a special place out here. I walked, there's a great little, what's the place on the corner, just for local color? That's like some kind of a taco pupusa place.
Yeah. So there's like 5 places to get pupusa around here, which is amazing because we're constantly like, you know, what's the best pupusa in the area? There's so much to choose from. So that place on the corner used to be like just a crappy, like, convenience store, Raj shop, selling like incense and, you know, an Atticoke, you know, Atticoke coffee. He closed, and then it became like a vape store, which we were all kind of like, well, that's lame. And then the vape ban happened a couple years ago. And then that store closed, and it was vacant for a long time. And then we heard that this guy was coming in, Tacos and More, and we're like, sweet, another taco place. We have.
I tell you, if you take the train, I'm going to push for the train because I'm into trains. Commuter train from Boston, the Framingham Worcester line. Get off in Framingham. There's a little some kind of taco place. There's a bakery. You keep walking, then there's a Brazilian restaurant.
Yeah, there's a Brazilian bakery, and then there's a Brazilian restaurant, Taras Basilias. And there's so many Brazilian restaurants.
Brazilian steakhouse.
And then there's Pupusa Grill, which is the little tiny kind of hole-in-the-wall place that makes, in my opinion, the best pupusa in the area. And they're wonderful. Like, you go in, and they've got, like, homemade horchata, and like they do it right.
Do people come here and walk from the train?
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly in the summer more. Once when our beer gardens open and we're outside and we got live music during the day on the weekends. We were finding that we had a lot of guests coming on foot and bicycle, which is cool. We put in a bike, you know, where you can lock your bike up and stuff like that. And the town asked us to do that when we first opened. I was like, they were like, it's required. And I'm like, it doesn't need to be required. I'm going to do it anyway. Like, I want people to show up on their bicycles, you know? And there's so many great spots around here. I mean, Framingham, we're right on this creek behind our brewery. And right on the other side is a huge neighborhood full of families. We have a lot of regulars that come in that live in the neighborhood. And they all walk or skateboard, You know, somebody's, you know, they're getting here somehow, and mostly not in vehicles, which is really kind of amazing. You know, I love the fact that, you know, we have a place where people can walk to and enjoy. And then, and you know, our neighbors down the street have a brewery, Jack's Abbey, and you can walk between the breweries. So that's always a plus to be able to, you know, kind of one stop in the area. You can park and then, you know, kind of go to both places and not have to drive around too much. So yeah, that part's really great.
Way back when, how did you find this location and why did you open in Framingham?
Not on purpose. I was on a trip with High Horse at the time. We were doing a little staff trip and we did our Boston trip. Jack's Abbey was the first stop, which is this location. So this is Jack's Abbey's original location at 81 Morton Street. And I walk in and I'm looking at their setup and I'm like, wow, they are at capacity. There is no way they can grow at all in this space. And Jack was here and Sam, his brother, and we're talking and I'm like, yeah, when you guys decide to move out, let me know. And he kind of gave me this like, actually, we are already planning to move out and we are thinking about what we're going to do. I was like, well, I'll call you Monday. And that conversation continued. And several months later, we were talking again and I said, you know, I'm considering, I'll buy your equipment and, I'm going to pull it out of there and bring it to Hadley where we're going to build a brewery for High Horse. And that project just kind of never came to fruition. And Jack said, actually what we'd prefer anyway is to leave it here and have another brewery here in town and to have the owner of a brewery that's pretty successful, has grown really well, obviously has proven to be even more successful with their new brewery, to say to me, we want you as a neighbor, was very telling and pretty authentic too. I felt welcomed and I felt like it was a great idea to, like, you know, there's other neighborhoods that have multiple breweries and they kind of all feed off of each other. And I'm like, yeah, I'll be the little brewery next to Jack's. No problem. You know? And
you know, that's a great story.
Yeah. And it's the way it happened literally. And it kind of, everything kind of fell into place and then we're opening. They're all here for our opening. They're, you know, we have so many friends that work over there. We share friends and we share guests, of course. And so I find out a couple weeks in, a couple months in, we're open. And all of a sudden, like, we get all these guests and they keep telling us, yeah, they keep sending us over here. Apparently, part of their tour was, you know, their brewery tour was like, you got to go see our old place. It's down the street. There's a new brewery there called Exhibit A and you got to go visit them. And so for them to tell the story about this location, I think certainly helped us on some levels, but it also kind of solidified the idea of camaraderie. And I think that some of the, you know, some people would say, oh, like, you know, brewery business is like, you know, 99% a-hole free or whatever. And I, you know, I'd like to consider myself, you know, part of that 1% or whatever, but, but I do think it's mostly good people in this business, you know? And I think we're all after success. We're all looking for, you know, a nice paycheck for our staff and ourselves and all of that. But I think the most important piece is creating this camaraderie within the industry so that, you know, the rising tide happens and we all are on top of it.
That's an amazing story about good karma, and that's kind of what not just craft beer is about, but it's also just for location and finding a place. You know, there's a good history here. You didn't have to go in and blow all this money and build out from scratch and look for gas lines and water lines and sewer lines and all that.
Yeah, that was helpful. But I won't pretend for a minute we didn't spend a bunch of money. I mean, we renovated the whole space. We redid the floors. We repiped stuff. I reconfigured the brew house. I put in a canning line. I added tanks. We renovated the entire tap room. And we created our own space out of a space that existed. But the enormous help of having an existing footprint done, you know, I didn't have to get a boiler installed. I didn't have to get, like you're saying, gas lines run, water lines run. I didn't have to do any of that. All of that was done. And the town kind of understood what we were doing because they, you know, Jax had been doing it for 5 years in this space. So they're like, I'm like, yeah, we're pretty much going to do what they did. But
it's like, we're taking over the pig farm.
Right.
Don't worry. Your neighbors won't be upset.
Right. Yeah. It's basically the same thing. And so I think there's some luck there as far as, like, you know, right place, right time. And I have a friend who's in the beer business who is like, you know, he had an opportunity to build from scratch or buy an existing facility. And I was like, just buy the existing facility. There's so many headaches you're not going to have to deal with. There's other headaches that you get from that. But, you know, I still find kind of goofy plumbing and goofy stuff that would, like, we're working with our plumber this morning. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know why this pipe is like that. Let's fix that, you know. And that's just, it was done that way back then, and we're going to change it, you know. There's something really gratifying about that, though, because it helps to create, I you know, any mistakes that were made, we've either fixed them, or we've learned to work with them, or we've realized they weren't probably even that big of a mistake, you know. And that part's kind of fun, like facility-wise.
You know, it kind of leads me to what is your day-to-day like? I mean, you're the brewer and kind of co-owner, co-founder.
Yeah, so my day has changed a lot in the last couple of years. I mean, our staff has also changed. So we have a fully brand new staff back there. I have two brewers, Kyle and Joe.
They're all robots now?
Yeah. Yeah, they're just, I just plug them in at night. Yeah. So Kyle and Joe are our brewers. Dara and Frank kind of run the packaging side of things. And then Andrew is kind of this quality and seller and packaging and kind of everything. And we have actually not as much experience back there as far as like years of brewing as some other breweries. But what we have in energy and desire and passion is you cannot measure it. It's unbelievable what they're doing back there. I also have two new people starting in a week. This woman, Justine, and a gentleman by the name of Brendan, and Brendan's pretty green. Justine's been a brewer for 3 or 4 years. So we have some, you know, some experience coming in, which is really exciting. I still get to brew, not as often as I used to. I was brewing 2 to 3 days a week up until about a month and a half ago. Before that, I was brewing like once or twice a month. About 2 years, like before the pandemic started. Once the pandemic hit, I was pretty much brewing. I was on the deck pretty much every day. And that's fine. It is what it is. I still enjoy brewing. I think the most enjoyable part of my day is that kind of walkthrough when I'm like, they've mashed in at 6 a.m. I stroll in kind of leisurely at 7:45 or whatever. They've already mashed in. I know that mash out's happening pretty soon for the first length. We're brewing 2 lengths every day. You know, they started kegging or they're setting up the canning line. Andrew's harvesting yeast. Dry hops are going in. Like, there's all this cool stuff happening. And I rely upon this staff a lot. They know what my expectations are. They're high. We have you know, a lot of SOP material that people can work with so that they understand the processes and what they need to do. Safety protocols. All of that stuff is really dialed in. And so I feel very confident in the staff. That part is amazing. And I've gone through stages of actually not having as much confidence in some of our staff over the years. Certainly not going to pick on anyone in particular.
And then let's talk about your GM. So what roles does your GM fill?
So I like to say that Kelsey Roth does every single thing in here except make beer. That's what he does. He is our compliance person. He does all of our design for our cans. He does, you know, and I will say, well, you're looking at just a kitten. So my daughter actually drew the kitten in the yarn, and Kelsey did the design elements. And so, but Kelsey.
How old was your daughter when she drew that?
She was 18 when she did that.
That looks pretty good.
She's 20. Yeah, she's in art school. And it was just kind of a fun little drawing of Toby. Being the little kitten that he used to be. That's our adult cat now. But yeah, I mean, Kelsey does everything. When people call in for, you know, or do email orders for either beer getting shipped out or merch getting shipped out, he's handling all of that. When I say compliance, I literally mean like he deals with all of
that. You mean literally the direct to consumer shipping that you actually have to do that?
Yep. We actually do that ourselves. We have boxes that we build and then put 3 to 4 packs into a box and ship them out. And that's something that, you know, I would love to say I'd like to hire someone just that does that. We don't quite have that much volume yet that would justify that, but we're shipping beer every week and we're shipping a lot of merch. Actually, I just got a call this morning for a guy that he lives like 15 miles from here and he wants me to ship him a sweatshirt. I'm like, I'll I'll ship you a sweatshirt, but it just seems silly.
Actually, you're wearing a, so this Kolsch style ale that I really like.
Yeah.
Goody Two Shoes. You're wearing the Goody Two Shoes sweatshirt. Yeah. Kolsch on the real Kolsch Exhibit A.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about one more beer. I love all your IPAs. I got to try the Sunday Paper Imperial Stout.
Yeah.
Tell me about that beer, but also the name, because I know music too.
Yeah. and some people like that.
You want to sing it with me?
We could sing. I'm
Sunday Papers. Is that Joe Jackson, right?
Yeah, Joe Jackson. So the reference is certainly that. But originally, I was hanging out with my dad. We were in Jaffrey, New Hampshire. And this is years ago. It's probably 6 years ago before the brewery opened. And I was like, I got to come up with a name for a stout. And I had this idea for like what the brand looked like. And the brand was basically like a mug, a circular mug stain on newsprint. And the idea that I had came from a poster I had seen that was basically like a woman sitting on her porch. She's got her feet up. It's a Sunday morning and she's reading the paper and she's putting her mug down. And every time she puts her mug down, it kind of creates another stain. And I just thought it was an interesting idea. Now,
it wasn't from the song.
Well, so the song came after. So that was what was going through my head. I wanted the nobody reads the paper anymore. My dad would, it was a big deal for my dad for us to get together and read the paper. And so I don't remember exactly what the order of how things happened, but there was a Joe Jackson CD up at that house. It came on, the song came on, and I was like, oh, Sunday Paper. That's like a great name for a stout.
Read it in the Sunday Papers.
Right, right. And so, I mean, if you want to just stand up and sing, go. And so that's when it occurred to me that, oh, I've got this idea that's like visual, but also there's kind of a cool music reference, which is something we always enjoy. Danko also is kind of a music reference from, you know, Rick Danko.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so Rick Danko, you know, I just thought, oh, Danko Grain.
Wait. Rye. The Danko Rye from Tor Eschner, who's my buddy.
Yeah.
That beer, what is that beer called again? Because I want
it. It's called Danko.
Danko IPA or just Danko?
Danko. Yeah, Danko. And it says in small letters, like, you know, IPA with rye.
And that's coming up. So we're going to jump. So yeah. The Craft Malt Conference is coming up, and we're talking with a very local malt supporter, brewer, Matthew at Exhibit A. I want to circle back to you're working on these concepts of what building better beer. What is that? And give us another shout out for your special project.
Yeah, I'm not going to pretend that that is all that original of an idea. I mean, for me, the idea of conceptualizing a beer starts with raw material, right? And my sister happens to be a filmmaker, and her dad made this reference years ago that editing film is like making beer. And we're like, what? How is that like making beer? He's like, well, look, I have all this raw material, footage, sound, you know, characters, and you have this raw material, grain, hops, character is the yeast and the water, whatever. You put it all together to this cohesive thing, and now you've got a finished product that someone can consume, whether it's a beverage or a meal or, in his case, a film. So I was like, oh, I love that. And in order to build the beer, you need the best ingredients. I don't want, you know, you can make a pretty reasonably good film with pretty reasonably good material, good footage, but can you make a world-class film with kind of average footage? Probably not. You can make a really good beer with great ingredients, but you could take really great ingredients and make this incredible beer, right? So I felt it was it was unfair to the beer, the finished beer, to not deliver or to not bring wonderful, world-class, both local and not local ingredients to it. So for me, building a better beer was really centered around finding the best ingredients. And for me, at the time, 20 years ago, the best ingredients, they weren't local. They were in Europe and they were in the Pacific Northwest for hops. So that's how I built the beers. So now we have access to all of this local, wonderful grain and hops and other materials that we could use. I've used like lemon balm and lemon verbena from Andrea's house, you know, that we put into a beer, honey from a local apiary, whatever. Like we have, there's so much access to other things that aren't just the four, the three typical ingredients you'd find in beer, or two, I should say, malt and hops. But yeah, so building the beer actually for me stems from finding the best ingredients and having them be purposeful. Like what's the reason? Like, why am I using that malt in there? Why is that particular rye malt, that Danko, why is that the one we want to use? And in that case, it's because the British rye tends to be really spicy. The grain coming from the Midwest, that's the rye grain, tends to be like real peppery. I wanted more bread. I didn't want that super pepperiness from it. I wanted it to be smoother and softer. And Danko delivered that. And we were like, oh, and it's cool.
I think that's when you first mentioned rye, you were talking about, you know, Jewish pumpernickel and caraway seeds. And I think a lot of people think of that. And I remember 12 years ago, there were more brewers trying to use rye IPAs. And I think the note that wasn't hit right was when they were trying to mimic flavors of other products.
Right.
But I'm totally there with you. When I think of like a good rye, because I'm into multi-grain cereals and breads, to me it's like there's a barley, there's an emmer, there's a rye. They're shades of grain, right?
Yeah, all of it. Yeah, each one has their, you know, there's many variables within each one. And like to me, the beer that really got me, that struck me on a commercially available level was Hop Rod Rye. And be it what, you know, Bear Republic, great brewery, great people over there.
Great one, man. Circa 2005, 6, yeah. 7, 8.
Yeah. And so I was introduced to that beer by them at Beer Fest here in Boston. You know, it was like a Beer Advocate Fest. And I think my booth was next to their booth or something. And we were hanging out. And I was like, oh, yeah, I got rye beer too. Like, check it out.
So what is that? That beer is a great example. The Hop Rod Rye from Bear Republic. What did that do with the rye that others weren't doing?
They just had a great balance. I don't know exactly what they were up to, but I mean, that was a pretty hoppy beer too, and big. Like it wasn't just like a little 5% beer. I think it was probably 6 or 7%. I don't recall exactly, but I just found it to be super balanced. And, you know, if you look at our logo, the scale, you know, I'm all about balance and in some cases imbalance when it's appropriate. But I do find, you know, with rye especially, you got to have balance. You got to have some sweetness to offset that peppery. You got to have, you know, the bread is going to be in the middle that's going to deliver on, you know, the mouthfeel and the character of the beer. Rye tends to dry out a lot. Like the malt itself will, you know, that the sugars in there will ferment. And so it's, you got to be careful not to make it too dry because then it's just going to show all of that pepperiness and it's going to lack the bread that you want and it's going to lack the smoothness that you want.
One last question. We're going to go back to talking about our local monster, Valley Malt.
Yeah.
You mentioned two examples where you work with them directly. One was the dextrin malt to like refine your Kolsch. The other example was when you went to them for porter, you wanted roasted malts. Is there another example where they've either come to you and asked for your help or feedback or vice versa?
We do that all the time. I mean, I spend so much time with them. In fact, I can't even think of a particular example other than the roasted oats in the Sunday paper. So we can kick right back to Sunday paper thoughts. I didn't know what a roasted oat would deliver. We didn't know. We did know that the husk isn't going to deliver the same color as a barley husk. So maybe we're not going to get as much color in the mash or in the wort, but we will get character from it. And so we use roasted oats, and we offset the fact that we're not getting much color from them by using more, in this case, chocolate rye and roasted barley and, you know, the very dark malts. And I haven't brewed a batch of that beer without the oats, so I don't really know, but I brewed other beers with oats and with roasted oats and then without those roasted oats. And that roast character, it's not acrid. It's not harsh. It is a smooth, just bomb.
Unbelievable. Naturally sweet, right?
Naturally sweet and just roasty without that overpowering acrid character, which is kind of the, you know, it's the only way I've been able to describe it is like that overly roasted coffee that's like awful, you know? So I want that smooth, soft roast that's just penetrating the whole time you're drinking the beer.
Well, dude, thanks for taking time with me, because I could definitely talk to you a lot longer, and I'm loving this. So it's just a kitten. I want to thank you, Matthew, because we're trying to put a little spotlight on just craft malt, local malt in general, especially with the Craft Malt Conference coming up. So thanks so much, man. Matthew, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Jimmy. I appreciate you having me.
And a big shout out to Armin, our engineer, who's going to clean this up, and it'll be live in February 2022. Thanks so much for joining us on Beer Sessions Radio. We'll catch you next time on Heritage Radio Network. All right. Woo!
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.